Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are calories such a problem for so many Americans? While people in some parts of the world struggle to take in enough food, the greater concern in the U.S. is the overabundance of it. When we eat more calories than we burn off, we risk health issues including obesity, heart disease, diabetes, and joint problems. So what are calories exactly, and what combination of public policy, corporate marketing, and human instinct make it such a challenge for many people to appropriately regulate their intake? Marian Nessel is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of Sociology at New York University. Her new book, written with co-author Malden Nesheim, is called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. Marian, welcome to Think.
Oh, glad to be here.
It is probably obvious why a book like this would look at the science of calories. Why do you feel the politics is an equally important part?
Oh, I write about food politics. It's my area of research. And it's just so obvious to me that there are huge industries that are involved in helping people go on weight loss diets or these kinds of things. The Food and Drug Administration is busy trying to figure out how to get fast food restaurants to label calories. And national governments are using calories to establish standards for the percent of their populations that are considered to be hungry and possibly malnourished. So you can't separate politics from anything having to do with food.
And in terms of the finances of this, it's, I mean, insidiously brilliant in a way that food companies that sell food make a huge amount of money selling more food than we need. And then the diet industry makes a huge amount of money trying to take that extra weight off.
Yes, if only everybody would just understand that all you have to do to lose weight is eat less, but never mind.
Why is that so hard? I mean, why are our bodies better at taking in enough calories to prevent starvation than at stopping when we have had enough?
Well, everybody invokes evolutionary theory for this. The idea was that in the far distant past, for millennia, and in fact up until the last 50 years or so, food was so scarce that bodies had to do everything they could to make sure that the brain continued to get enough glucose and that we could keep functioning. And so the regulatory system for weight, hunger, and satiety developed to defend the brain's need for glucose and to do everything possible to make people want to eat if their blood glucose dropped. And that has carried forward into a time when food is plentiful, available everywhere, and cheap. And it turns out the regulatory system is much, much better at helping us gain weight than it is to help us lose weight.
So one thing that you've discovered over years of researching all this is that lots of regular people don't actually know what a calorie is. So give us a good working definition.
Well, there's a very good reason why people don't know what calories are. A chemist's calorie is the amount of heat energy necessary to raise the temperature of a milligram of water 1 degree centigrade from 14.5 degrees centigrade to 15.5 degrees centigrade at 1 atmosphere of pressure.
Give what, and that's break. Not simple enough?
Yeah, give me a break. I like to put it in a much more, I like to translate it into something that people can actually understand, which is that if you have 100 calories, and these are now the calories on food labels, which are 100 times bigger, 1,000 times bigger than the calories that I just talked about, 100 calories on food labels, 2 Oreo cookies, is enough energy to raise a quart of water to the boiling point.
Hmm.
And that's an amount of heat that people can have some feel for. That's a lot of heat. We don't boil when we eat a 600-calorie dinner. We've got 6 quarts of blood because that energy is tapped off in metabolism in ways that keep us warm and keep our basic body functions operating. And that's the kind of thing we talk about in the science part of the book. We hope in a way that's accessible enough for everybody to understand it.
Yes, so tell us about what happens to a calorie after we have consumed it. And this, by the way, is a calorie of pretty much anything in terms of the energy we get from it in the body.
Well, you don't really eat calories. What you eat is protein, fat, carbohydrate, and unfortunately alcohol, which are the sources of calories in food. So we eat food. We don't eat calories. We eat that food, and then enzymes in the body break down very large, complex molecules of food that store physiological energy, and we break them down into smaller and smaller pieces during digestion and then after they're absorbed into the body, and each of those breakdowns releases energy that can be used either to power body functions or to keep us warm.
And if we have too many calories, that gets deposited as excess weight, excess fat, and if we're not able to burn them off after we consume them.
Well, that energy is used to take the surplus small building blocks of protein, fat, and carbohydrate and construct them into storage forms of those nutrients, unfortunately mostly fat.
Mm-hmm. So one way in which this gets political is decisions that are made about how foods are labeled so that we as consumers theoretically have information about what it is we're putting in our bodies. And it turns out that some foods that seem fairly low in calories depend a lot on portions that are far smaller than what most people eat.
Yes, when the FDA, I always laugh about that, when the FDA had to deal with the whole question of food labeling, which, you know, didn't start until the early 1990s, when Congress passed the food labeling law in 1990, and then it took 3 years or so to get those rules into place when people actually started putting them on food packages. The FDA used as the basis for portion size surveys of dietary intake that had been done in the 1960s and 70s. And those were much smaller than portion sizes are now. So they seem artificially small. The one that I like to use as an example is a portion of ice cream. A serving of ice cream is half a cup.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but I don't know about anybody who eats a half a cup of ice cream.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be very strong-willed to do that. And most restaurants serve more than that. And certainly if you're going to eat it out of a container, you're going to be eating more of that. But that's the standard serving size. And what's so difficult for people to understand, because it's not intuitively obvious, really not, is that if you eat more, you're going to be taking in more calories. And I like to say that if I had one thing I could teach the American public about calories, it's that larger portions have more calories. I can't even say it with a straight face. But it's not intuitively obvious. It's really not. And that's been shown by very clever research that's looked at people who are trained to understand that larger portions have more calories and that larger portions confuse people into underestimating the number of calories that are in that portion by a much larger extent than do smaller portions. And you take people who've been trained and know all that, and you put larger portions of food in front of them, and they'll eat more. Everybody does.
Marion, how did those portions get so much bigger? Why is a restaurant meal now the size of, you know, what might have been
four.
Two or three meals? Four.
Four. Four for me, anyway. I had a doctoral student, Lisa Young, who, for her doctoral dissertation in the 1990s, did a research project to answer exactly that question. And she examined the introduction of large-sized portions into the food supply and showed that they started coming in the early 1980s. And in fact, if you plot the introduction of large-sized portions from the 1980s to the year 2000, it exactly parallels the rise in obesity. Hmm. You don't really need any other explanation for obesity than large portions. Large portions have more calories. More calories encourage people to gain weight. It's really as straightforward as that. To look at the reasons behind that gets us into politics in a really big way. And there were the basic rationale for large portions was deregulation, and that's political. And there were three types of deregulation that occurred in the late 70s, early 1980s that I think account for a lot of this. The first was of a deregulation of the way we used to support agricultural production. Mm-hmm. We used to tell farmers not to grow so much food and pay them for letting their fields lie fallow. In the 1970s, that shifted to paying farmers for producing as much food as they possibly could. And that encouraged big farms and encouraged greater production. And the number of calories in the food supply went from 3,200 per capita in the early 1980s to 3,900 per capita in the year 2000, an increase of 700 calories. Hmm. Those calories had to be sold.
Yeah.
And they also made the food industry very competitive because they had to be sold. The second area of deregulation was Wall Street. Wall Street used to value blue chip stocks. You never hear anything about blue chip stocks anymore. Mm-hmm. Blue chip stocks were stocks that gave long, slow, but steady returns on investment. Starting in the early 1980s, something happened called the shareholder value movement, which encouraged Wall Street to evaluate companies on the basis of high returns on investment, immediate. And so then Wall Street started putting pressure on corporations to grow. Every 90 days you have to produce growth and show growth to Wall Street. And you see the results of that horrible business on Wall Street right now. But for food companies, it was devastating because they were already trying to sell food in an environment in which food was far more competitive than they had been used to. And now they not only had to make a profit, but they had to grow their profits every 90 days. And the third one had to do with deregulation of marketing. That opened up the possibility of marketing to children in a big way, or in a bigger way than had been done before. And that combination of things put a lot of products out on the market, a lot of cheap products out on the market, and a lot of introduction of food into places where it never had been before. Bookstores, for example. When did it become okay to eat in bookstores?
It is funny that there's almost nowhere, traveling abroad, you notice that there are parts of the world where there isn't a food availability about every 100 yards. And in this country, that's not the case. It's everywhere.
It's absolutely everywhere. There is food in drugstores. I live in Manhattan, and the Duane Reade drug chain has just turned into a supermarket. Hmm. It's quite amazing and very convenient. There's food at Staples. Staples is turning into a grocery store. There's food at clothing stores. I mean, this is just astounding. But it sells. Food companies had to find ways to sell more food in an extremely overheated and overcompetitive marketplace. And they did that by putting food everywhere, serving it in bigger portions because big portions are cheap, and marketing to children and everybody else.
So we have all these cues of a giant portion. Even if we don't eat the entire giant portion, we may be eating more than we need and feeling virtuous because we haven't finished a huge plate of something.
That's exactly how it works. Mm-hmm. You know, even if you leave it on the plate or ask to take it home, you're still going to eat more than you might otherwise. And there's tons of research by now that demonstrates this.
My guest is Marion Nestle. She is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health and professor of sociology at New York University. Her new book, co-authored by Malden Nesheim, is called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. We have phone lines open now if you'd like to join us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health and professor of sociology at New York University, Marian Nessel. Her new book is called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I want to talk a little bit about the school nutrition program, which is part of the Farm Bill. There was a time when the concern was ensuring that students in schools got enough calories every day, and these days the problem is quite the opposite.
Yeah, actually the school food is not part of the Farm Bill except for fruits and vegetables in it.
Okay.
It comes out of another piece of USDA, which makes it really hard to talk about. But it's got a long history. Which piece of the history do you want to know about?
Well, we'll talk about the way that our approach to school nutrition has changed over the years.
Well, the approach to school nutrition in the beginning was just to... The whole business of school meals started out as a way to dispose of surplus agricultural products. The government was buying surplus agricultural products as part of its farm support program, and it had a lot of stockpiles. Those didn't have a market, and so they were donated to schools to use in order to feed kids lunch, and that over the years and decades evolved into a very different kind of program in which there are now standards for school meals and commodities are a much, much smaller part of them. And the government buys large quantities of food to serve in the school meal program.
Can you tell us a little bit about the meat industry? Because it was recognized some time ago that we should not be eating nearly as much meat as the average American consumes. But messages about that have been tentative, to say the least, from the government.
Actually, obfuscating, I think, is a better way to put it. Because the government, when it first started, for years and years and years, Americans didn't eat enough, and so dietary advice was always to eat more. When heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, those kinds of things became greater problems, health problems in the society, then the advice had to change. And starting in the mid-1970s, there was a big effort to try to advise the public to go easy on the kinds of things that were going to raise the risk for heart disease in particular, and that was saturated fat, salt, and calories in general. And the biggest source of saturated fat in American diets in the 1970s was meat, beef particularly. And so the original recommendations from the first committees that were looking at these things were to eat less beef. The beef industry didn't like that. And every state grows cattle, raises cattle. They're raised in every single state. Every state has two senators. And the beef industry exercised its considerable muscle and complained bitterly. And almost immediately from the very beginning of dietary advice about how to reduce risk for chronic diseases, the advice was expressed in euphemism. It wasn't eat less beef. The advice was reduce your intake of saturated fat. And since nobody knows what saturated fat is or where it is in food, the government, you had to be in the in-group to know that. And only people in the in-group knew that saturated fat was a euphemism for beef. And even today, up until the most recent dietary guidelines, the ones that came out in 2010, they said reduce your intake of solid fats and added sugars. They didn't say eat less beef and drink fewer sodas, except in the small print way in the middle of the report.
Wouldn't it make sense to just say it in that plain language that makes perfect sense to people?
Well, they can't. They get killed politically. And this, I might point out, is an election year. Nobody's going to do anything like that in an election year.
Let's talk about high fructose corn syrup. This has become a major target of a lot of people's ire at the food industry. How did so much of this end up in our diets, and how is it really different? Is it truly worse for us than refined cane sugar?
Oh, yes, that question. High fructose corn syrup was one of the things that grew out of those changes in agricultural policy in the 1970s. Suddenly, we had a big surplus of corn, and corn producers looked for ways in order to turn corn into higher value products. And one of them was high fructose corn syrup, which is an enzymatically treated corn syrup that adds fructose to what used to be just glucose syrup. Corn syrup is glucose, and high fructose corn syrup is fructose and glucose in roughly equal quantities. Mm-hmm. So what they did was to turn high fructose corn syrup into something that was just like table sugar, or close enough to table sugar that it could be used in the same way and taste the same and pretty much the same way. And it was cheaper than sugar because the price of sugar in the United States is kept high by a system of price supports and quotas, whereas the price of corn is kept low by a system of subsidies to large agricultural producers. So the price of high fructose corn syrup was about a third of the price of table sugar. And so starting sometime in the late 70s or early 1980s, all of the soda companies switched from sucrose to high fructose corn syrup because it was so much cheaper. And high fructose corn syrup got put into a lot of processed foods because it was so cheap.
Foods that would otherwise have contained sugar.
Yeah, and they would have cost more, mm-hmm. although marginally more.
So the addition of all this high fructose corn syrup, again, makes it easier for us to overconsume because we're not paying so much for these items that we ought to perhaps be eating in much smaller quantities.
Yes, and low price is an incentive to buy something. You just don't think about it if you're not paying very much for a food item, whereas if it were more expensive, you might think twice. Sugar is still pretty inexpensive, even though Americans pay three times the world market price of sucrose or table sugar.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. First on the line, we have Jim in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Hey, first comment I'll make after listening for half an hour, I don't know how your guest has an ounce of optimism left in her. Just sounds,
oh, I'd be happy to talk about where my optimism comes from.
I can't wait to hear it. I just hearing it so far, it's just like, oh my gosh, there's so much of a bummer in all of this. However, my question has to do more back to the idea of the political part of it, and particularly something happened in the not-so-distant future where the First Lady came out and was really trying to make a push about nutrition, particularly for children in school, et cetera. And, you know, it was just so disheartening and so disturbing to have her be attacked in the way that she was by the right, you know, for the idea that, you know, how dare she step on our freedoms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, we find ourselves in this horrible predicament with health care, and the one thing that, you know, the politicians and the pundits and the leaders of this country should be talking about is how nutrition and health and exercise plays such a huge part in the impact of where we find ourselves health-wise, and then as a result of that, how that affects our health care costs. And it is the absolute last thing that they talk about, particularly because it becomes so politicized, and it just disheartens me so much. I'm a healthcare professional, and I take care of these people who ultimately find themselves in the hospitals with all three of the diseases you spoke about, you know, obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, et cetera, and they are, not exclusively, but in many cases, the direct result of these freedoms that are being passed around by the right as something that we should be able to do without any intrusion from anybody who's in charge. So just a couple of comments there.
Oh, well, thanks for the comments. I don't know, is there something specific that you want me to comment on?
I'm guessing maybe just in general, how you feel. Maybe you can talk about the First Lady's efforts to improve nutrition for children.
Well, I actually think for me personally, this is a thrilling time to be a nutritionist because I've never lived at a time when the First Lady of the United States was interested in the same kinds of things that I am. I'm thrilled by that. And we have here a First Lady who has no elected power, no real power, no legislative power, no genuine authority, and yet she has used her leadership to bring the issue of childhood obesity and access to food in inner city areas to national attention. And I have nothing but applause for that. If she isn't doing it exactly the way that I would do it, if she's not succeeding in putting curbs on the food industry, I think she's doing what she can do. And she's doing what she can do under the most under the most intense scrutiny and intense criticism from people who don't like what she's doing. So I have nothing but applause. I think what she's done is just absolutely remarkable. And for a lot of people who are working in these areas, this has been truly inspirational. I do want to say something about the first point that the caller made, which is about where my optimism comes from. I'm enormously optimistic about these issues. I deal with young people all the time who are interested in food issues, thrilled about food issues, want to work in the what I call the food movement, and make changes that are going to have a positive impact on people's lives. And the wonderful thing about food is that you as an individual can do something to make those kinds of changes and make them real. You can go into a school that isn't serving very good food to kids and fix that and change it so that the schools are serving excellent food to kids. You can get farmers markets in your area. You can develop urban farming in your area. You can get nutrition taught in your area. I mean, there are hundreds and hundreds of groups throughout the country who are working on these kinds of things, and they're enormously attractive to young people. And what I see is that these changes are coming. I can see the difference in what the food supply is like now from what it was 20 years ago. Food is much better now. You can get healthy food everywhere if you look for it, or almost everywhere. There are some places where you can't.
Maybe not the vending machines.
Maybe not the vending machines, but you really can get good food in many, many places where you never could before. And I know so many people who are growing food and are interested in it and care about what our food production system is doing the environment and to our climate and to people's health, and they want to change that. So I think what's happening is thrilling, and yes, it's a struggle, and no, it's not a mass movement yet, but the numbers are growing, and that seems like a really positive sign to me.
Talk about this, if you would. I do the grocery shopping for my family, and if you don't pick up a package and look at those labels on the back, very often you'll see a word, a phrase, something like multigrain on a package of pasta, which may be made with multiple grains but not be made with whole grains. Talk about the ways that food marketers sometimes trick consumers into thinking they're getting something that is more wholesome than they imagine.
Oh, well, the FDA has no standards, no official regulatory standards for whole grains on foods. And so food marketers, if they put anything, any kind of whole grain in there, can put it on the label and use it as a health claim. The whole business with health claims is where the politics comes in, because it used to be that the FDA didn't allow health claims on food packages at all. And then when that Nutrition Facts Labeling Act was passed in 1990, it required food companies to say how much saturated fat, sugar, and salt they had in their products. And the food companies said, well, if we have to say what's wrong with our products, you have to let us say what's good about them. And the Congress agreed. So this is a Congress problem. Congress opened the Pandora's box and said, yes, you have to. You, the FDA, have to allow food companies to start putting health claims on food labels. And at first, the FDA required a lot of scientific substantiation for those claims. But over the years, the food industry took Anytime the FDA turned down a claim, the company sued the FDA, and the courts backed up the companies on the grounds of freedom of speech and freedom of commercial speech. So the FDA has kind of, it has its hands completely tied, and given the particular political climate we're in now and the particular Supreme Court that we have now, it's very unlikely that that's going to change. So the health claim area is kind of a free-for-all.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Diane on the line in Hearst. Hi, Diane.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
I have a general question about whether your guest has done much research into kind of the romantic relationship that people have with their food. Myself, I've always been thin and athletic, and even now at age 40, I'm still, I guess, a bit of a lightweight at 140 and 5'7", but I have friends that are very much overweight, and no matter how much they complain about wanting to lose weight or needing to, they constantly eat, and they're trying to force feed me by putting food on my plate to get me to eat more. And, you know, even when I look at themselves or their children and even their dogs and cats, their animals are overweight. So I'm wondering, is there something in our food these days that are making people more addicted to eating, or is it the advertising that's kind of encouraging people to eat all the wrong things? Or
what do you think, Marion?
Food is very, very much a question of culture, and it's also a question of identity. People, you know, it's something that we're putting in our bodies. I can't think of anything more intimate than something that you put in your body, inside your body. So people have very, very strong emotional feelings about what they're eating and how they eat and their patterns of eating. And these are very much ingrained into us when we're young or taught to us while we're in school. And it's one of the reasons why dietary patterns are so difficult to change. Because they're so deeply ingrained and so much a part of our personalities. And the unfortunate thing about the problem of overeating is that it's almost impossible not to, because our entire environment is set up to push food on us all the time.
Let me jump in. We have to take a quick break here. My guest is Marion Nestle. Her new book is called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Marion Nestle, professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and professor of sociology at New York University. Her new book, written with co-author Malden Nesheim, is called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. And before the break, Marion, you were saying that it has become nearly impossible for most people to avoid overeating, at least occasionally, because we are surrounded by cues to overeat?
Constantly surrounded by cues. And if our particular social circle is a social circle, as the caller explained, where food is being offered all the time, we're going to eat more of it. I mean, one of the things that school food advocates are so concerned about is the enormous amount of throwing candy around and cupcakes and celebrations that are taking place in school. Somehow they got the idea that kids can't go for more than 2 hours without eating something. And kids are being offered junk food all the time. We had a doctoral student here at NYU who did a study in New York City schools and said that it was not unusual to find that kids were being given an additional 600 or 800 calories a day in school just from celebration foods alone.
Wow. Another thing that is not labeled is alcohol. And a lot of Americans get a lot of calories from alcoholic beverages.
Well, if they drink a lot, they get a lot of calories. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was one of the big surprises for me in doing the research for this book. I somehow had the idea, I should have known better, but I somehow had the idea that alcohol calories were metabolized in some funny different way. Mm-hmm. But if you're a normal person with a normal liver, alcohol calories are going to be metabolized in your body exactly the same way as all other calories, and if you drink too much, you're going to put on weight. And this was known way back in the late 1800s. Those studies were done by Wilbur Atwater, and they've been confirmed over and over and over again in the 100 years since. So all of those calories count. And alcohol is weird in other ways, too, because it's not regulated by either the FDA or the USDA. Because alcohol is such a source of revenue, it's taxed so high, it's regulated by the Treasury Department, and the Treasury Department has a conflict of interest because the Treasury Department wants to collect more revenue, and therefore it doesn't want alcohol companies to do anything to discourage sales. Well, whereas people who are concerned about health think it wouldn't be so bad if people didn't drink quite so much.
Let me ask you about that, because you mentioned that there are very high taxes on alcohol. It is clearly not much of a deterrent to people who are determined to drink more alcohol than they need. Does that tell you that maybe something like, people have proposed soda taxes or sort of sin taxes on junk food, maybe those wouldn't deter people from overconsuming those items?
They might not. It would depend on how big they are, but that experiment has yet to be performed. Mm-hmm. And in part, the soda tax idea is on the one hand to try to discourage sales, and on the other hand, it's to try, I think, to send a shot across the bow to the soda companies that they really are very much at risk in concerns about obesity, because there's so much evidence that sodas, which are sugars and water and nothing else, are a factor in people's overeating calories.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Plano. We have Philip on the line. Hi, Philip.
Hello, Chris. I love your show. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question about the cultural aspect of this discussion. My fiance is Chinese, and she's 95 pounds dripping wet, and I'm a Texas boy, and I'm 6 feet tall and weigh 210. And my fiance is very concerned about health and calories and nutrition in general. And when we go to a Chinese restaurant, we almost invariably split one entree, and each of us eats half, and then we take some home. And I'm wondering if this issue and this problem extends across all ethnicities in the United States, or if there is a particular culture that tends to be healthier in their food choices than others. And I will hang up and listen with my gratitude.
Thanks for your call. What do you know about that, Marion?
Well, the healthiest eaters in the United States are the people who have the most money and the most education. And that's across the board, regardless of race, religion, ethnicity, whatever. The healthiest people are the wealthiest. And and you can think of lots of reasons why that's true. They tend to be better educated, so they know about diet and health. They have more money to buy healthier foods. They don't have to think twice about what they're buying. They have decent health care. We live in an enormously inequitable society, and the highest rates of obesity are in the groups that have the least money, and that's just part of the social inequities that we all deal with.
What could we do to improve government food aid programs like SNAP to encourage better choices or to make better choices available to lower-income families?
Well, right now, the easiest one to answer is the one about making better choices available. And there are large numbers of experimental programs that are in place now that are allowing the recipients of SNAP benefits, food stamp benefits, to use to get more for their food stamp benefits if they buy healthier foods, fruits and vegetables in particular. And they can buy them at farmers markets. And these programs are sort of trying to, it's in a sense a subsidy for fruits and vegetables for low-income people, which, you know, I think is a really good idea, because if people think that fruits and vegetables are relatively expensive, it's because they are. The relative price of fruits and vegetables since 1980 has gone up by 40%, whereas the relative price of sodas has gone down by 30%. So there's something very strange about that. And the government price support system subsidizes junk foods, but does not subsidize fruits and vegetables. And not only that, but forbids the recipients of subsidies from growing fruits and vegetables. I mean, this is just weird and really needs to change. That's a farm bill issue. Your other question, which has slipped out of my mind for the moment, had to do with... the first part of it.
I suppose how we could change the way these programs are set up.
Yes. Right now there are the stipulations on what food stamp recipients can buy are only that they're not allowed to buy pre-prepared food, alcohol supplements, and a couple of other things. I mean, they're very, very limited.
And pre-prepared is basically restaurant food is what they're talking about.
That's prepared food. Yeah. You're not allowed to buy prepared food, mm-hmm. With some exceptions. But the, I mean, I don't even know how to say this. There's a lot of sort of ideas out there that people who have food stamps eat worse than people who don't, or are buying junk food with their food stamps more than the general run-of-the-mill public that don't have food stamps. The Department of Agriculture does not collect data on what food stamp recipients buy, so that question cannot be answered at the moment. And the idea that you could put in some restrictions and allow food stamps to go further if they're buying healthier foods, or restrict sodas or other kinds of foods, those ideas are all in play right now. But without some baseline data, I just don't think they're politically feasible.
So, Marion, you sell a lot of books already, but you could be a millionaire if you started selling books that said this is the secret diet that works. You eat this combination of foods and not that one. Tell us what you know about the relationship of particular types of foods versus simply calorie intake and output in terms of what we each weigh.
Okay, well, here's the complicated piece of this. If you talk about weight all by itself, separate from all other attributes of health, calories are what count. Calories in, calories out, the body does not care where those calories come from. They're going to be treated in the body in exactly the same way. You eat too many of them, they're going to go to fat. If, however, you're concerned about health and about making it easier for yourself to manage the calories that you're eating, then the quality of those calories becomes very important. If you eat a diet that has a lot of fruits and vegetables and you're not eating a lot of junk food, it's going to be much, much easier for you to maintain your weight, and you're not going to be overeating calories at the same time. And it's very, very difficult to keep those two things straight. They're different.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be thought of in sort of different categories. And what a lot of the diet plans do is to try to blur those calories and say, well, if you just don't eat carbohydrates, you'll lose weight. Well, of course you'll lose weight. You won't be eating as many calories. But the studies that look at the changing of protein, fat, and carbohydrate proportions within diets show that the high-fat ones work pretty well for the first 6 months. After that, people gain the weight back just like they do on other kinds of diets. And that there really isn't, if you measure exactly the number of calories that people are eating and you do it under those studies under controlled circumstances, it makes no difference where the calories come from. If you do it in real life out in the real world, some people find it easier to lose weight on diets that have more fat. They're more satiated, they feel better, they can do it better, but they still have to undereat calories to lose weight.
At the end of the day, you are not a proponent of really obsessive calorie counting. You're a proponent of learning appropriate portion sizes. How do we do that?
You have to have a scale. Mm-hmm. There's no other way to do it besides measuring your weight on a regular scale, a bathroom scale. If your weight is going up, you're eating too much and you need to cut back. For me, the easiest way to cut back is to eat smaller portions. Other people find it easier to do, to manipulate the quality of the diet, whatever works for you. But you measure it on a scale. If your weight is staying roughly the same over time, relax and enjoy what you're eating because you're doing it right.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Jessica in Southlake. Hi, Jessica.
Hi there. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
As a registered and licensed dietitian with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, we were actually just in Washington, D.C., advocating for nutrition education with the Farm Bill and Older Americans Act. And that education has been shown to improve the choices that the individuals make, helping to reduce some of those diseases we were talking about, diabetes, cardiovascular disease. And I was wanting Dr. Neffel to talk a little bit about how providing this education is really critical for helping the overall society and population to make better choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm greatly in favor of education. I'm an educator. I just don't think it works very well.
Why not?
I think we have to, because the environmental cues are so powerful that people can't resist them even if they're educated. And I already gave that example of educated students confronted with large portions eat more calories from those large portions, even though they know that the large portions have more calories. I don't think education alone can do it. We need to create a food environment that makes it easier for people to make healthful choices and makes healthy choices the default rather than what we have now. And that's why politics is so integrally related to everything having to do with calories and weight balance and nutrition education and the whole works. We need to fix the environment so that healthier foods are cheaper. So that healthier foods are advertised, healthier foods are more available. And when that happens, it will be easier for people to make healthy choices.
And is it your sense that there is no chance the markets will do this on their own, that this has to be based on a greater amount of government regulation?
Well, the markets can't do it on their own. I know lots of people who work for food companies who dearly wish that they were making healthier products and weren't obliged to push their products in the way they are. But food companies are not social service agencies. They're businesses that have stockholders that demand that not only do they make a profit, but they grow their profits every 90 days. And no matter what food companies want to do, they're obliged to increase sales.
Marian Nessel is professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, and she's professor of sociology at New York University. Her new book, written with co-author Malden Nesheim, is called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. Marian, it's been a very interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs we have planned, and download the free daily podcast, all online at kera.org/think. If you've got questions, comments, or suggestions, send those along to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.